Trib Live Radio presents Off-Road Politics from Main Street to the Beltway with Selena Zito, reporter at the Pittsburgh Trib. Trib Total Media, see what's next. Now, here's your host, Selena Zito.
Hi, welcome back to Off-Road Politics. I'm Selena Zito, reporter and columnist at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. And on the show with us today is, if I don't mess up his last name like I always do, it's David Petrucha. Do I have it right, David?
Yes.
That may never happen again, David. So let's like bask in this warmth for a moment.
It's the spelling online that we've really had problems with.
Oh, well, you got all these. It's spelled P-I-E-T-R-U-S-Z-A. So when you look at it, it's like, wow, does the I before E, but it's not after a C? Is Mrs. E knocking but not talking at the backyard? You've got U's and S and Z's and A's, and it's just all over the place.
But yeah, it's got four. Yeah, it's complex.
It's complicated. And you would think for someone who is a writer, I could be a better reader, but I just didn't even want to mess with that. So welcome back to the show, David. If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at DPIETRUSZA. He always has something wise and kind of funny to say. David is what my go-to historian. He's just an amazing man full of all kinds of information. I mean, anytime sort of something stunning or big happens in politics, I always go to you, David, because pretty much anything that's happened has happened before. And you always make that point, right?
Yeah, here's a free interjection, not about the book, okay?
Yep.
Some analyst, a Democrat, I believe, said that Hillary Clinton has a leg up on the election because of illegal immigration, okay?
Yep.
And the reason is not because they may vote for her, but because they distort the census and congressional representation, and thus the Electoral College.
Oh.
Okay, think about it, right?
Yeah, right.
Right?
Right, absolutely.
Now what, but we've been there before.
And when was that, sir?
In the progressive era, in the Jim Crow era, blacks are saying, we can't vote in the South.
Right.
Why are you counting us?
Right.
Okay. And at approximately the same time, suffragettes are saying, we can vote in Wyoming, but we can't vote in the South, or we can't vote in New York or Massachusetts. Why are you counting us there?
Right.
So we've been there before. This is even more complex than the two-thirds rule. But anyway, I digress.
No, and when you digress, we always learn something.
Yes.
You are one of my absolutely favorite authors. You have a new book out now, 1932, The Rise of Hitler and FDR. And it's a tale of politics where these two men come to power and make these completely different decisions, and they take leadership of countries that are at some of their lowest points in their history, and the intersection between these two men and all the events are fascinating. But before we talk about that, I have to point to a couple of my favorite books that I suggest that people read, because I've learned so much about them, and one of my favorites is 1920, The Year of Six Presidents. Can you just give people a little overview, because I just love that book.
Well, that's where we get into that whole women's suffrage thing as a backstory. It's about the election of 1920, and it's called The Year of the Six Presidents because you have so many presidents in play that year. T.R., if he does not die in 1919, is the nominee. Is the next president of the United States, the comeback kid.
Right.
Woodrow Wilson is still president. He thinks he can get a third term. He's sort of delusional at that point.
Yep.
Warren Harding gets elected. Calvin Coolidge is a favorite son. He is the vice presidential candidate who beats another vice presidential candidate, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And then got Herbert Hoover, who's not quite sure what party he's belonging to at that point. He wins two Democratic primaries. And then he ends up as president in 1928. So you've got all these guys coming together. You've got the League of Nations, prohibition, women's suffrage, all these great backstories going on. And a whole bunch of strikes. You have strikes and anarchists, terrorism, Wall Street bombing. It was a great topic to stumble onto.
Yeah, I mean, and wasn't FDR almost, I mean, just narrowly escaped injury at a New York City bombing?
No, that was in Washington.
Oh, that was Washington.
Where that precedes the Wall Street bombing, but it's the same bunch of guys. They're tied in with Sacco and Vanzetti, who are the big cause célèbre at trial of the 1920s. And the anarchists try to blow up the Attorney General of the United States of America, A. Mitchell Palmer.
Yep.
They get as far, or the fellow gets in as far as the middle front step of his house. We know that because that's where the deepest part of the crater is. There's not much left of him.
Yep.
But his scalp lands on the roof of the house across the street, which is occupied by Franklin, Eleanor Roosevelt, and all the little Roosevelts.
That book right there, I mean, it just reminds us that if you think today is bad, you really need to have a better understanding of our history. You need to understand better understand how complicated our politics has always been, and likely always will be.
And if you think there's going to be a straight line left-right as we see it today and transpose that same thing to our history before, you're going to see, particularly in that era, where you're going to say, well, that person should be on that side, and
right.
They're not.
Right.
They're not. It's taken a while to get to this point, and what that means is that the points in the future are not going to be as clear-cut, or we're not going to be able to predict where we're going.
And you have two great books on Calvin Coolidge, a documentary, and it was on C-SPAN.
Right.
That's why. I can't say your last name.
Welcome to the Dyslexia Channel.
Well, yes, actually I am.
Right.
That is my problem, but with your last name. And
right.
The Silent Cows, the Almanac, which was just great fun.
That one did very, very well, and that was featured on, we did a feature on not only C-SPAN, but Glenn Beck on that when he was on Fox, and I'll tell you, that can really assist sales, particularly back in those days.
Oh, absolutely.
And that was fun doing, and you know, basically Cal wrote these books, and I just put them together and helped with the Coolidge revival, which is still going apace. They're reissuing Robert Sobel's book at Regnery about Silent Cal this month. So
That's awesome.
People are starting to say, you know, Reagan is great, but there is another model. There is another
absolutely
heroic conservative president out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Calvin Coolidge has always been on my top list of favorite presidents. And before we get to your new book, one last book that just blew my mind because LBJ blows my mind. It was 1960. LBJ versus JFK versus Nixon.
Yeah.
Your book and the Cairo books, the series of books on LBJ, that man is an amazingly fascinating man.
And his impact continues to this day, maybe more so than FDR when you get down to
absolutely.
It. Absolutely. It's the Medicaid, Medicare programs that he implements, the Vietnam War, which unhinges a lot of things, and that 1965 Immigration Act,
yep.
Massive influence. And the whole 60s, the country blows apart really under
yep.
his watch, and it's yet to be put back together again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we will be feeling the effects of LBJ longer than any other president for a very, very long time. So let's get to your new book, The Rise of Hitler and FDR. I mean,
yep.
It is, you can't stop reading it as soon as you beginning with the first page. How did you get to, what was the impetus? What made you say, God, I got to write this book?
Well, I had done those three other presidential election year books, including the 1948 Truman Dewey
yes.
thing. And you have a formula which works for you, but at some point you're reaching a point of diminishing returns, or the other good ones are taken or whatever, and you take a look and you say, well, 1932, perhaps the Roosevelt-Hoover race by itself is not as dynamic as you would like, even though it's occurring at a real watershed in American history. But it's like, take a look at that whole year, because these books are focused on years and the backstory, and there's a big backstory going on in 1932, maybe not in America,
right,
but in Germany. And these two guys, Hitler and FDR, run their elections in 32, take power in 33, both die within a week or two of each other in 1945. And the subtitles, Unlikely Destiny, Hitler essentially a bum earlier in his career, you know, a homeless person, a high school dropout, a fellow who should be really almost executed for treason in 1923.
Yes.
No citizenship in any country. He doesn't get citizenship in Germany in 32. How's that for being an unlikely Führer the next year? I mean, he's an illegal Aryan up to that point,
right,
in 32. And Franklin Roosevelt, you know, a patrician, a cousin of another president, very remotely, but his physical infirmity does not help. That's one reason why he's... In some ways it helps because it inspires some people, but in other ways he has to keep it generally hidden from the public. He doesn't want to emphasize it too much. But he's considered to be shifty on the issues, a true lightweight, you know, sort of a airheaded rich guy. And many people, particularly in the liberal end of the spectrum, the conservatives have enough reason to suspect him, although he's all over the lot in 32. Some of the speeches in the Democratic platform adopted in Chicago of that year are seriously conservative, seriously cost-cutting, tax-cutting. He gives a speech in Pittsburgh, yes.
Of course.
Forbes Field,
yep.
At the impetus of Joe Kennedy and some of his Wall Street backers, which is arguably to the right of Coolidge.
Yep.
It is like, cut the government by 25%, cut this, cut that, cut the regulation. Quite amazing. But people like Walter Lippmann and Haywood Bruin and Bernard Baruch are saying, this guy's like an amiable Boy Scout. He has no great qualifications to be president and no great agenda to bring to it. So he's got people like Joe Kennedy and Baruch who are sort of on the right of the Democratic Party backing him. And then he has seriously crazy, wild people backing him on the other end. Huey Long,
yeah,
not that very skeptically, but not skeptically at all, is Father Coughlin.
Oh, yes.
Father Coughlin. And he is just massively in love with Roosevelt that year before he will break with him in a few years. There's also another priest on the scene who leads a march on Washington, not the bonus march, not Father Coughlin, and his name is Father James Cox,
yep,
who is from Pittsburgh. And in January of that year, there is a very large march to do something about the Depression on Washington, and Cox later runs for president. His run does not go very well, and he literally runs out of gas in New Mexico. I mean, like, there's no money for gas, and he is stranded there, and they have to figure out a way to get him back home to Pittsburgh. So it's a lot of strange things going on, very significant in many ways, and then you've got these odd little characters flitting in and out.
Oh, there's so much intrigue in this book. The impact of the press, William Randolph Hearst. You know, there's the New York City scandal. I mean, and in Germany, that country is just absolutely devastated and so ripe for someone, while we look at him through the lens of time and don't see him this way because of everything that we know about him, but at the time he comes across as this very charismatic leader who's going to right the wrongs of Germany and bring it back to its place in history. And it is a collision and an amazing book and an amazing look at what happened in 1932.
Right. We don't get it, obviously.
Right.
But his events are like rock star events.
Oh,
these are
right.
like rock concerts.
Oh, my gosh.
Where everybody, the flags are flying, the searchlights are going off, the drums are drumming, and people pay. People pay to see him. They don't just, like, you know, how are we going to fill this hall? That's a big part of Nazi Party finances, these rallies where he appears. And one of the ways he keeps the party in line is, you know, unless you're doing your job in Nuremberg or Bremen or whatever, I'm not going to schedule my appearance there. It's a very strange dynamic and different dynamic. And one of the American reporters says, in most political rallies, the candidate, the leader, appeals to the people for their support. And there in Germany, the people come and beg Hitler to be with them. So it, even before he takes power and you get this mythic godlike figure of being propagandized by Goebbels, a particularly loathsome figure, I might add,
yeah,
it's there's things going on there where he is the man and how he does it. He's very skilled. He's very skilled at the beginning of the year politically. He's making all the right moves in 1932. And then at the end, the mask sort of starts to fall from his face. And you see the encouragement of really horrible violence that scares the voters of Germany. So he loses 2 million votes in the November Reichstag elections, the Nazis do. And it looks like he's, to use a phrase from a later part of the Hitler history, has missed the bus. But in fact, he hasn't, because German politics is so broken that the machinations lead to him being installed as chancellor as sort of a last gasp of, you can't figure out who else to give it to. The German parties, well, you know, the American two-party system has its problems, okay? But there's like 13 parties at least with delegates in the Reichstag in Germany in 32-33. And nobody can cooperate with anybody. The socialists, not with the communists, the nationalists, not with the Nazis, the Catholics, not with this person or whatever. It's very bad. The system is totally broken. And you take a look at those elections, you're getting the majority of the people voting communist and Nazi. So you've got the majority of the people freely voting for totalitarian systems. Then you add in the authoritarian vote for the nationalists, and then the socialist vote, which is big government. You've got 70% of the people voting for that four-party spectrum, which leaves the moderates a very small group, a disappearing group in Germany at that point. This is a really broken society. The war, they start 1929 with the Depression with a sizable unemployment rate. It gets up to 6 or 7 million people by 1932. People are just scared, silly. They don't know where to turn, and they turn in the wrong way.
And that's often what happens during economic uncertainty. And you can see that we've had these lows that have coincided, and these and this disruption in our political system and in our society when we're filled with high unemployment or a large sense of uncertainty of where our future is going.
There's a whiff of dictatorship sentiment going on in America at the same time. where these guys, respectable guys like Walter Lippmann and Al Smith, are making talks about, you know, we've got to have this Iron Man rule. And they're willing to give it to Roosevelt, who they did not even like. They are so desperate. Dwight Eisenhower, who is serving under Douglas MacArthur at that point, says, people call me Dictator Ike because I say this is what's got to be done in this country to fix it. You know, Dwight Eisenhower is not exactly George Patton. He's like the essence of moderation, and he's feeling it. There's a film called Gabriel Over the White House, which Franklin Roosevelt helps vet, that William Randolph Hearst makes, which is about a president who becomes essentially a dictator of this country. And then there's a film which another studio puts out called Mussolini Speaks, which is essentially a big commercial for Benito Mussolini. It's
right.
Made for $100,000, and it grosses over $1 million. You try making that amount of money in the Great Depression. That was a big hit.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, David, I mean, it has been really great to have you on the show. Guys, we're talking to David Petrushka. No, Petrushka. Right? I got it right.
Petrushka.
Yay.
Yes.
He is the author of this fabulous book, 1932, The Rise of Hitler and FDR. You can follow David on Twitter at DPIETRUSZA. Right? Did I get that right?
Right.
I'm so proud of myself. And you can find his book on Amazon. David also has a really great website where you can see all of his books and some reviews and some excerpts. I highly recommend you go to it. It's David Petrushka, DavidPetrushka.com. Is that right? Did I got that right?
Yes.
Yay. David, thank you so much for joining Off-Road Politics. Are you going to be, can we find you anywhere else talking about, are you going to be doing anything on C-SPAN or?
We're still trying to put together this C-SPAN. I think we will be doing the John Batchelor show in November, and we'll be sneaking in and out of media around the country. So, we're hoping to be pitching this wherever we may.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I highly recommend the book. I highly recommend every one of his books, all the way back to your baseball book, which is also one of my favorite. But then again, you know, I'm a baseball freak, and you know what tomorrow is, right? The Pirates and the Cubs.
Yahoo!
And you know who I'm supporting. But it's great to see two, you know, sort of iconic, old, original baseball teams going battling for that wild card spot. So it's going to be great baseball tomorrow. David, thank you so much for joining Off-Road Politics, and I hope to have you on again soon.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.